parasitology seminar for December 2nd, 2010. I'm going to talk about the ROOT project from last summer, and ROOT stands for Research for Undergraduates in Theoretical Ecology. This is a NSF program funded from a grant that was initiated a number of years ago and has really supported quite a bit of interesting undergraduate research over the years in a variety of places. This year we got funding for a project on the parasites of damselflies, and I might just talk a little bit about why one would select damselflies as parasites, and particularly damselfly gregarans, as an item of focus or an area of focus. Over the years, I think out at Cedar Point, certainly we've been doing damselfly gregarin projects for a variety of reasons. First of all, they're easy. Second, the hosts are easily captured. Second, there's a pretty good diversity of them. Third, the students appreciate how easy it is to make slides and get data out of them. And so we've had really dozens of people over the last 35 years who've done student projects on these parasite systems. And the reason, and as a result of that, then, there's a massive amount of what I would call experience, not so much hard good data in the files, but certainly experience that lets a person make reasonable decisions about what to study and how to study it and what you're likely to come out of it with. Secondly, gregarins, as most of you know, really are macroparasite mimics. And so they don't reproduce as such inside the host, even though they produce cysts that produce, in turn, literally thousands of oocysts, which are the infective stages. They don't reproduce as the life cycle forms in their hosts. And so that means then that they behave exactly like certain kinds of worms and ticks and so forth. So they behave like macroparasites, and so we kind of consider them the arapidopsis, if you will, of the parasite world. Ischneura verticalis is one of the most common and widespread of all damselflies, at least in this country, and they literally occur by the tens of thousands at many collecting sites, so that's no problem collecting them. They are sexually dimorphic, male and female, and that means that you can at least assume that there are some behavioral differences and physiological differences, and indeed there are some pretty observable behavioral differences between the sexes. When I started looking for pictures on Google Images, this one came up, and the main reason I stuck her in there is that that's Tammy Percival Cook, who is the describer, was a graduate student here and actually described a couple of the species that our students ended up working with this summer at one of the sites. And I put this one in here to sort of remind us that when you get paired up with a mathematician and spend a semester watching this stuff happen, then it's pretty amazing. So that's really, if you want to go look into the parasit teaching lab in fourth floor of Mander Hall and walk through there, you'll see what's left over from last spring's derivations and calculations and what have you. So this is sort of an introduction to the ROOT project. You're not going to hear a lot of science today. What you'll hear is mainly a description of this project and just a brief look, or what I should say, a very abbreviated look at some of the scientific stuff that will come out. The students selected five sites. They sampled them every 2 weeks. They set up a sampling schedule. Well, actually, they spent all spring semester doing math and learning the techniques of how to actually dissect hosts, get information out of them, how to do the measurements, how to capture the images. It went on and on and on. And when it came time to actually go to the field out at Cedar Point, they all went out there, selected five sites, which they sampled every 2 weeks. It was sort of a staggered sampling. One of these sites, Gaiman Parks Pond, was so rich that they slanted, and it was very close to the field station. So they sampled that one repeatedly, over and over and over again, and sometimes daily, and they used it for, as a source of all kinds of material to do some experiments. So they did a semester of math modeling, and right now they're also doing then the fall semester. This semester we're meeting once a week, and they're doing some additional modeling, and they're working right now on some draft publications of this. The data set that came out of this this summer was is simply staggering. It's I've never seen anything at all like it in terms of parasite ecology, and I'll talk about it here in a minute. Literally thousands of measurements, literally thousands, and several different kinds of things that I'm calling experiments in quotes, because they're not really experiments in the experimental design sense, but they're experiments in sort of the math bolic sense, where you simply ask a question about what happens if you bring a couple of components of a life cycle into the lab, try to do the infections. And one of the reasons for doing these things was, the main reasons for doing some of those go back to the mathematical models, where David can continually ask, what's the value of this parameter? What's the value of that parameter? How do we obtain a value of such and such a parameter? So what's the reproductive rate? What's the cyst production rate? What's the growth rate? All of these sort of things that go into the math. So there were several of those. Pardon? No, I'm not going to do it. I don't trust my technology. So the people, Elizabeth Tracy, there were five of them. Elizabeth was a student in my 101 class, and then she and Ayla both were students in field parasite in 2009 and actually worked on damselfly parasites, so there was some field work there involved. Austin Barnes, math major, Brittany Bunker, also a math major, and Matt Schumann. Well, Brittany and Austin are both combination math pre-meds. And Matt was actually a math major who was between his freshman and sophomore year. So there was a diversity of folks involved. The places, if you've been to the field station, then you know the places are pretty familiar to you. This is Gaiman Park's Pond. It's right up as you come over the last hill before you go into the field station. There's the Gaiman Parks Welcome Center, and there's a little pond behind that. They have a well and a well tank, and it drains into this pond. And this is one of the most remarkable damselfly places I've ever seen. Little Beckius is down the Sutherland Canal a little bit. I do, toward the end, have a Google map that shows some of these things. Nevin's Ranch is a site that we've, over north of Paxton, that we've used for years and years and years for both teaching and research. Dunwoody Pond, of course, is famous in that regard. Dunwoody Ditch is right by the town of Keystone. And so all of these, there are really five of these sites. So the main studies were what I would call a combination of kind of classical sort of parasite population dynamics coupled with some measurement stuff that's really sort of straight out of the old taxonomic literature. But when we get down here a few slides later, I think you'll be surprised at what came out of all of that. So these are the main studies that took place. Some of them were far more successful than others. The enclosure cages for emergence. If I have time at the end, I'll elaborate on that one a little bit. But this is what we did. Now, when you actually see some slides, or at least one slide that involves measurements here a little bit, there really are four of these. A, B, C, and D. And these are measurements of the two compartments of the cells. So this is the protomerite, this is the deutomerite of a Gregorian trophozoite inside the insect gut. And what happens, the figures that I'm going to show are only of one species, Actinocephalus carolinii. And what happens is that when these things get big enough to actually see, then you realize that in an infection that contains a large range of ages of these parasites, that this compartment of the cell gets very, 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 very long. So most of the increase in size really comes about as a result of growth of that second compartment of the cell. So these are interesting parasites. Okay, well, and these are the main things as a result of listening to David and listening to the students and watching them do their math all spring semester. Then I kind of made the decision based on what I learned from them as to what we should be doing in terms of collecting numbers to actually help put real data with some of the equations. Next one, Scott.
Wrong way.
Here you go. So the main questions that we were asking: what are the population distribution parameters? That's the, you know, if you're studying parasite ecology, that's the first question you ask. And the distributions of best fit. And of course, your default assumption is that these distributions will be aggregated and probably best described by the negative binomial. What's the relationship between host life cycle and developmental stages and the parasite populations? This question really comes out of a long, long, long series of studies that we've done and that some of my graduate students have done, and some of you heard about this. This is really the underlying question of Scott Snyder's doctoral dissertation, of Rich Clopton's doctoral dissertation, of Matt Bullock's dissertation, of Gabe Langford's dissertation, and student after student after student at the field station. And it's this question right here that I felt for a long, long time really needs to be addressed when we start talking about host parasite evolution, the evolution of the combination. And then we also tried to really determine, estimate or infer some of the rate values for movements of infective stages through these systems. Next one. So here's kind of what some of the data look like, and you know, there's no need for you to actually even try to read that, but what it consists of are counts, collection codes. These are code numbers to identify the person who actually did the dissection. This is our host, Ischneura verticalis. This is our life cycle stage, larva. Middle larva, young larva, and terminal larva. So we sat before we actually started. We sat down and semi-arbitrarily decided on these three stages that we would distinguish. And the young larvae were ones that, well, all of them you can see the banded eyes, and that's the main decision-making feature that we use to make decisions. They were of a certain size, and middle larvae was everything from that size up to those that had full wing pads, and terminal larvae were those that had full wing pads. And Gaiman Park pond, and we did head width, and we did total length, sex, numbers of Gregorins, numbers of mites, numbers of ectocommensal paratrix. And then we also actually had two labs set up out there in Cedar Point, and students worked in their own rooms, and then lab two would come over and verify the data collection from lab one and vice versa, and that's what that yes stands for. So from Gaiman Park's larvae alone, this particular data file has 613 lines. And so remember that there are four additional sites that have pretty good collections, and then there are lots and lots and lots of adults. Probably another 1,000 to 1,200 from Gaiman Park's. And the data sets look exactly like that. Okay, next one. The measurement data looks something like this. So here's, again, your host number, date, collection, length, so forth. This happens to be a different species, Steganorhynchus dunwoodii. So going back to the figures here, A, B, C, D. So column C is the one that that you'll see in some later ones, life cycle stage. In the file from room one, there are 13,000 plus measurements, and these were all done using the video microscopy setup. And these are actually the numbers here are actually centimeters on the screen. So those are screen measurements, and there's a conversion factor over here, and the lens that happened to be used. So those things can all get converted, and they have been really to micrometers. And then there are about another 9,000, maybe 10,000 similar measurements of individual Gregorians from the other room. And I'll talk about why those measurements are of interest to us a little bit later. And then we also got the stuff from the other places. Okay, next. So here's an example of this is one little example of trying to answer a mathematical question, trying to answer one of David's questions about infections. And so these nine columns are really the nine collections from Game and Parks Pond. So we're going to ask, is there any relationship whatsoever between age of the host and numbers of parasites? These are all Gregorians. And you have to remember, though, these data are not really sorted as to Gregorian species. So I just simply didn't have time to do that, although Brittany has done that for her first paper. So the first three rows are really correlation values. This is head width, which is a common measure of maturity in damselfly larvae. This is total length without adding in the leaf-like gills at the end. So this is the end of the abdomen. This is the correlation of head width versus total length. In other words, does the head actually grow like the body and so forth? This is the mean number of parasites, variance of the parasite distribution, prevalence, and the number of damselflies involved. So, a simple question, is there any relationship between host size or host age and numbers of parasites? Does the host acquire and keep additional parasites as it gets older for whatever reason? And the answer is absolutely no. And so if you go through these are R values, so if you square those, you get your R squared values. And quite frankly, they're all totally insignificant. And so as illogical as maybe it sounds, quantitatively at least, they're really, a little host is the same as a big host. A young host is the same as an old host. They're all the same. They're all equivalent. So this, that's an example of simply counting and measuring that answers a fundamental question that the mathematicians would ask. And that's exactly where that comes from.
And I might add, that is really surprising to me, because a typical model of ingestion, for example, of parasites and infection would be some kind of random process, like a Poisson process, where they eat and they're consumed randomly, and you would expect the buildup over time through some random process. That's very surprising.
It's a little surprising to me, because I don't think any time in the last 35 years we'd actually systematically looked at the small larvae on purpose. And generally, students are not as patient as these five students were, and they never had the time in class to actually do that work correctly. And these variance to mean ratios, of course, are your first indication that all of these distributions are going to be aggregated. But these numbers right here And if you plot your means and you look at your prevalences, aside from kind of one little semi-outlier early in the season, these things are all surprisingly close. And if you do a chi-square on prevalence, which is not really necessarily, the statisticians would probably blow their stack at it, but if you did that across there, you'd find that there really is not much statistical prevalence difference. And the means, if I remember this correctly, we did do, in fact, analysis of variance of the means and discovered that, yes, indeed, even though there are a couple of these that look large over the whole summer, there really is no significant difference between sort of parasite burdens. There are some sampling differences in terms of extent of aggregation, and that tends to get produced by picking up a heavily infected one or a couple of heavily infected ones and so forth. So this particular set of table, this particular table, which there are also tables like this for the other four collecting sites, is I think a kind of a major contribution conceptually. How does this host parasite system actually behave in nature? Okay, next one. You can start with the top stuff there in parentheses. And I might digress just a little bit. Back in the old days, when we drew our pictures with a pen and a square and triangles and a Leroy lettering set, you could make them look exactly like you wanted them to look, and they looked good. And with the Office Suite 97 to 2003, the PowerPoint slide sort of graphing function was really logical, I felt, to the point that we used it over and over again to actually make graphs that we then converted to JPEGs and submitted for publication. Between 2003 and 2007, the PowerPoint function of Microsoft Office Suite somehow or another lost every bit of its logical click. So whatever it was, I just want to say it. And furthermore, your ability to actually make that graph look the way you want it to look is severely constrained. I just hadn't figured out how to do it. And I even sat down and took a lesson from Nicole, who works in our lab, who's really pretty good at this. And I found it just such an insult to my intelligence. And I don't know how to get the graphic. I'm just about ready to go back to pen and ink and Leroy, because I've still got my father's Leroy set. It still works. So, yeah, at any rate, you all know that these are supposed to be bar graphs, but they're not, just simply because the lines look a little more interesting and a little more mathematical. But here is an example of the population structures of Gregorans in Ischneura verticalis over these nine collections, and each of these lines is a separate collection from Game and Parks Pond during the whole summer. And so what this stuff really tells you is that there does not seem to be, your first visual, your first reaction to the picture is that there does not seem to be any major shift in the way parasites encounter their hosts over the course of this sampling period. And so the shape of these curves really, in my view, always is a reflection of the dynamic events by which parasites encounter hosts. So if every host got exactly the same number, then you have a line across here. If if the average number of parasites was really the mean of a bell curve, the thing would look like this. But over the course of those 9 collections, the only thing that really pops up in some of them is a few of these heavily infected individuals down here at the end. So whatever's going on in terms of directing the way in which these hosts and parasites come together successfully, you'd have to say that that operates continuously. You don't have to factor in a fundamental difference in what's going on. Okay, next one. Now, this is one that's sort of interesting, and this really gets us back to a biological, mathematical, geographical kinds of questions. These are adults. The hosts now are adults. And what I've done is picked up a technique that when Stephanie Watwood and Erica Peterson use it in their description of a new species of Gregorin from Tribolium castaneum, then the reviewers got really irritated, but it got published anyway. And the more I've looked at these kinds of measurements, not only with Gregorins, but also with all of the species that we have in beetles, everything we've studied, over and over and over again, these deutomerite measurements, if you take a lot of them from a single host and you rank those deutomerite measurements from small to large and then plot them according to their rank, you get these kinds of curves. And this is one individual, adult, and that's this curve right here, and one individual tenneril. And the tenerils are those that are collected the morning after they emerge. So you go out there every morning and pull up a newly emerged damselfly and do these dissections and measurements. So the question is, do they carry them over from the aquatic habitat to the terrestrial, knowing that all of the sort of ecological factors that produce encounter in the water are different than those that are likely different than those that will be affecting the encounter up in the terrestrial environment. So there are lots and lots and lots of these adults. This stuff all comes from the thousands, tens of thousands of measurements that were done. And over and over and over again, I can tell you that with this particular species, Tenacephalus carolinii, then those curves always look like that. And with the tenerils, that same species, they always look something like this. So there's some things you can infer by this, I believe, that that have some kind of biological significance. What I don't have, and I just simply didn't have time to do it, is a bar graph showing you the means and prevalences of different species of Gregorins in the two life cycle stages. So in the larval stage, the predominant Gregorin is Saganorhynchus dunwoodii, which is a very different one than Actinocephalus carolinii, which is predominant, very much so, in the adult. And even though both life cycle stages share both parasite species, the larva is way predominantly Staganorhynchus dunwoodii from Gehman Parks, and the adults are predominant in all this stuff. So something's going on. Either your adults are continuing to get infected, and nobody knows how adults get infected with Gregorins because the oocysts that are in infective stages are in the water. And adults don't spend much time in the water. Some of them go in there for a second or two to lay eggs. But by and large, if these are new infections, then they're picking them up from prey. They have to be. So the other question is, do the hosts continually get infected? And in general, this interpretation of a variety of sizes those curves are interpreted by us, at least, to mean that, yes, indeed, there's almost continuous infection, gametocyst production, it's going on all the time. Now, and the other thing about, as an aside, that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with this particular project, is this little blip right here. And when I first saw that, I said, okay, there are a few big ones. And when that little blip, this is a bigger blip than you usually see, but when that blip starts showing up in the ranked measurements of every Gregorian parasite we have studied, and that includes Steganorhynchus dunwoodii and damselflies, Echinocephalus carolinii and damselflies, all of the species in the tenebrionid beetles that we've described and have been there, if you take those measurements and rank them like this, they all have that little dip. And I just have this sneaking suspicion. I haven't been able to figure out a right way to test this, but I have a sneaking suspicion that something's going on that keys this sort of spurt. And that may be a developmental event that cues gametocyst formation. Because when you look at all of the parasites in the gut of a host, most of them are not anywhere near gametocyst stage. But when you start measuring gametocyst production, you see that you get a few gametocysts every day out of a parasite host that has a whole lot of cysts in it. So, for those of you that haven't heard this before, Echinocephalus carolinii was the first damselfly Gregorian that had been described in this country for 50 or 60 years, I think. Described by Sarah Richardson, who is now faculty member at DePaul. She came to Cedar Point threatening her sister, "I'm going to find a parasite and name it after you," and sure enough she did. So this is named after Carrie Lynn Richardson. And the night that Sarah discovered that her gametocysts had sporulated, and so we had all the data that needed to actually make the description, we went into town and got some microwave burritos. Nowadays, I know that microwave burritos generally have about 800 to 1,000 calories. Okay, next slide, Scott. Like I say, the data mining on this project has really just started. So we might ask, what kind of information, what kinds of questions, what kinds of adjustments to your paradigms really arise from this kind of a study? And the answer is a whole lot. If we can look at the next slide. Here are the sites, of course. Okay, so this is, it doesn't look like it's supposed to. You're supposed to be able to see Cedar Point right in here someplace. I think that's it. So here are the collecting sites. This is Lake McConaughey. This is Kingsley Dam. This is the Game and Parks Pond. This is actually Big Beckus. Little Beckus is right there. Dunwoody Ditch is here. This is for scale. This is a square mile in blue. This is Dunwoody Pond up there. And the next slide is a smaller scale. Again, here's your square mile, and this includes then Nevin's Ranch, which is over here north of Paxton. So one immediately starts asking, what kind of an effect does geography or pond difference have on this system? Now, our assumption is that the host parasite system that you're looking at is an evolved one, and that the parasite doesn't necessarily go into every kind of an animal, from birds to rodents to beetles. You know, it's pretty well stuck in damselflies. And there's a reasonable amount of evidence that we have not followed up on yet that what we're calling Actinocephalus carolinii and Ischneria verticalis may be a different species of that genus, but it's because the epimerite is a little bit different, but those body proportions and the protomerite structure are such that, and the oocysts are such that you can never, you know, it's so close, you can call it that, at least for our purposes. So, when you begin factoring in geography, then, and not only geography, but the diversity of habitats involved, the invertebrate communities that are in those habitats, the plant communities that are in them, and they do differ. It's the places in which this single system is taking place really vary quite a bit. And not only that, there is the question of the movement of adult damselflies between various sites, because you know from the literature that they are supposed to get up and move. Now, one of the things, let me get back to the enclosure cages. Austin Barnes is a very skilled carpenter. And one of the things he did early on was make these beautiful cages. I mean, they're just gorgeous, perfect. They're commercial grade. And the idea then was to use these cages in a variety of ways. One of them would be to put adults in there and try to feed them things. And, you know that's not going to work, but they had to try it anyway. But when it got to when the damselflies actually started emerging, then we said, "Oh, this is a good idea. We can determine whether or not these emergents, if you keep them in the place where they emerged, then whether or not they become infected, more whether or not they're infectious." So, the 1/8-inch hardware cloth was presumably big enough for prey to fly in and for emergence to stay in there. The emergence got out of those cages every time. And but you put the adults in there and they stayed in. So the tenerals, something's happening behaviorally that those tenerals will crawl through an 1/8-inch hardware cloth mesh and leave. And the full adults, with their wings hardened, won't do it. So there's some damselfly behavior there that I think is really studyable and probably has some parasitological significance, but it means that you can't do that little study that you wanted to do. So adults, the one thing we do know is that larvae from all of these places are not heavily infected with Actinocephalus carolinii, but the adults are. Much more so here than maybe over here, but nevertheless, they are. So there's something going on between parasite species that we don't have a handle on just yet. Now, the other question is, if we go back, Scott, to keep going. Yeah, to this one right here. The other question is, Are these tenerals, late larvae? These are actually, these are what, 4 or 5 hours out of the water. So, are the late larvae? Do they actually have a bunch of cryptic infections somewhere down inside the gut lining? And so what those root suits did was they dissected out the guts of probably a couple of hundred terminal larvae, fixed them in buoys, and about 30 of those guts are now in blocks. And Stephen Ebers, who's come into the lab, has started sectioning those. And so if indeed histological study of those gut tissues will reveal tiny little parasites or intracellular stages, then we'll find that. Okay, keep going. It's going down. Keep going. Oh, to the infamous life cycle diagram. And this really gets us back to the Matt Bolick talks that you've heard over and over and over again. This is the famous Clopton picture of Gregorina cuneata and mealworms. This picture, the question, I think the philosophical question is a life cycle picture the right intellectual framework, the right paradigm to use for framing evolutionary questions? And if you're not a parasitologist and haven't actually done this kind of work in the field or watched students do it, then your first reaction might be, yes, indeed, there is pathology here, and so the host may die. Well, down at Barry's, Brent Nickel said that to me one time over these larvae right here. And I just said, Brent, they don't have many parasites. He said, how do you know that those parasites aren't killing them, the little ones? I said, okay, we'll do that experiment. So Renee Stockland did that experiment. And she did it by getting literally millions upon millions of these oocysts, which are not, you know, it's not very difficult to collect those things, and particularly with Gregorina cuneata. And she took adult Tenebrio molitor, put them in containers to lay eggs, washed the pupa, okay, put the pupa in media, let them hatch, let them lay eggs. So she ended up with this big supply of, you know, over the course of a couple of year period, a big continuous supply of larvae of various state sizes. You know, first instar larvae, second instar larvae, third instar larvae, all large. She started feeding them tens of thousands of oocysts. And she also used food coloring to mark food and measured their feeding rates and their intake and how fast stuff went through the intestine, and discovered that even if you put 50,000 oocysts in 1 cubic centimeter of flour, and then you do sort of the measurements and the calculations, you discover that a first instar larva doesn't eat enough to actually take in an oocyst. And just from measuring the volumes, your statistical chances of actually picking up an oocyst don't even, you know, get above unmeasurable until these larvae get to about the third instar. And even then, just in terms of the volume of food taken up, it's about one oocyst a week when you get when you have a cubic centimeter of flour and one single larva and 50,000 oocysts in there. And in all of my retirement cleaning out, I found Renee's data. So at any rate, question always is, which of these events really makes a difference in evolutionary terms? And I'm not sure any of them do, except at some point, the number of these things, I have a feeling, if you were going to think teleologically and say, what does the parasite need to do in order to survive? And the answer might be just simply produce enough of those to override all of the vagaries of habitat diversity, of weather, of time, and what have you. And all of this other stuff probably has no evolutionary significance at all. Okay, let's see what's next. Here's my acknowledgement slide. There's David. I got you right off the math web page. Matt, Brittany, Elizabeth is not very cooperative as a photo subject. Ayla is the one who drove the vehicle when we harvested that particular host. NSF, local landowners have been very, very, very good to us. And, of course, Cedar Point. That's about all I have to talk about. Quite frankly, I don't think I've ever encountered a host parasite ecological data set like this one. Yeah. And it's entirely possible that Brittany will be able to go back out again next summer if she wants to. So I think we're going to be able to do that. And the mathematics of this, I'll let David comment on sometime when he's ready. It's just watching it from afar has been a real education for me. But Brittany has taken the lead on writing the first paper, and right now she's actually doing some Poisson sampling with the probabilities in turn varying according to gamma distributions or something of the sort. Am I close, David?
Right.
Yeah. Which I think is a real insightful move. Yeah. Anybody have any questions?
A quick question.
Sure.
So has anybody looked at their prey species to see if they have gregarins in them and if that's really where they're picking
them? The question is, anybody looked at their prey? There's one publication that an ARBO paper that presumably shows an oocyst stuck in the bristles on the leg of a crustacean. I'm not convinced. Just because of the size things on those SEMs, I'm not convinced. One of the things that Brittany was going to try to do was try to answer that exact same question. And it's a little bit of a zoo management activity that if you haven't tried this before, you need a summer to kind of figure out how to do it. But to get the oocysts and then get a large supply of them, your organisms, your hosts have to produce the gametocysts. Gametocysts have to go and sporulate, and you have to keep those. And then for the larvae at least, the big issue is ones that are already clean. So you have to raise your own daphnia. And the larvae eat staggering numbers of water fleas. That's their main food, at least from what's left in the gut. So raise your own daphnia, which one of my former grad students actually did, but not to do the feeding experiment, but just to feed her larvae to keep them alive. But then you have to ask, will the daphnia pick up the oocysts in large numbers? And the answer is they probably will. Megan Wise did this beautifully with snails and gregarins of leeches, and those gregarins and the snails are much more cooperative than the daphnia and those other. And she showed absolutely that the leeches that eat snails get the gregarins because the unsporulated or the unexporulated oocysts go through the snail's gut.
Yeah. But didn't you show that most of the adults are getting infected and not the larvae?
Well,
we really need to find out what the adults are eating that are transferring their parasites.
Yeah. The adults have Actinocephalus carolinii in very large numbers compared to the larvae. So they're either getting it from prey, or which are likely to be small midges, you know, anything they can catch. But I'll tell you, working with damselflies and doing experimental feeding, that's, you need to win Powerball and sort of wipe your slate clean for a year or two.
The toad one.
Yeah, just like the toad one.
Two major ones to work on out there.
Yeah.
So win that, and then you can fix it.
I'm trying. Somebody wins it, you know. It's $120 million, and I go back the next day, and it's $20 million. So somebody is winning.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.